Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most people affected by changes in school funding at the state level in Ohio, that is taxpayers, students, and their parents, have little or no idea what that involves. That's because it's complicated. More than 20 years ago, lawyers duked it out in courtrooms from Perry County to downtown Columbus, where the Ohio Supreme Court finally decided that the method of state funding was unconstitutional. 12 years later, and without a resolution, the Ohio Supreme Court relinquished jurisdiction, and here we are. This time, Governor Kasich's last in office, he has proposed a plan that would cut funding to well over half of the state school districts, shifting state support from shrinking districts and those deemed properly wealthy to help themselves. Today, we'll talk about what this means and the alternatives, if there are any. Howard Fleeter joins us from the Ohio Education Policy Institute. That's a nonprofit education funding research organization supported by dues from members ranging from school districts to statewide education organizations. He has been dealing with this issue we were talking about before we went on the air for as long as I have, since 1991. So welcome to the show, Howard Fleeter.
Thank you, Ann.
I feel like I know you because I've covered you so many times in testimony before the Ohio General Assembly.
That's right. Well, it's nice to meet you in person and happy to be on the show.
So. Thanks. Also, from the conservative think tank, the Buckeye Institute, senior analyst Greg Lawson. Welcome back, Greg.
All right. Great to be here, as always.
I'd like to hear, and I warned you about this in advance, I'd like to hear how each of you describe the state funding formula at, say, a cocktail party or maybe your kid's soccer match or whatever, if you casually tell them, Howard Fleeter, what you do and what you've been doing
That's
for the
right.
last 20-odd
That's
years.
Right. So I'm an economist. I was a professor at OSU for 10 years. That's when I got involved in school funding in Ohio before the DeRolf lawsuit. I've been working on it ever since. When I'm at a cocktail party and I don't want people to run the other direction and they ask what I do, if I tell them I work on education and school funding, the simplest way to explain our system is to say that we've got over 600 school districts, K-12 districts, every one of them levies at least 20 mils of property taxes. And the problem with that is that there's tremendous disparities in property wealth across all these districts. So what that does is it puts there's a responsibility for the state to step in and provide additional resources that they direct largely to help the lower wealth districts and also to make sure that every district has an adequate level of expenditures. So in the DeRolf lawsuit, there were really two issues at play. There was equity and adequacy. They both derive from issues of local tax base. And, the school funding formula itself has about a dozen components. And it starts with the base per pupil amount, which this year is $6,000 per pupil. And the idea of that is that's supposed to be the amount that it takes to provide an adequate education to the typical student. Then there's a number of components because there aren't a lot of atypical students.
Because
and we fund provide different money based on that for special ed, career tech, poverty, kids who are English language learners, transportation costs vary tremendously across districts. So the formula is meant to direct more money to the lower wealth districts that can't generate it themselves, and to also make sure that all students in all districts, regardless of where they live, have access to an adequate education. That was the whole point of the DeRolf suit.
Because the disparities aren't just in wealth, right? They're also in circumstance.
Yes.
So you
yes.
can have actually a technically high wealth district in Ohio, but have a lot of other issues to grapple with. Greg Lawson, how do you describe the school funding system?
Well, I would suggest they get a drink
at a cocktail
first.
Party. And how many drinks?
That's
do you
a good
need
idea.
Yeah,
that's
maybe three or four drinks beforehand. Okay. Then we should start talking about it. No, actually, I say, look, it's very complicated. That there's obviously a lot of interplay between the state and the local governments and the taxes. But I always say that the local tax base, there's always a lot of challenges there. So the state does try to compensate for the disparities that are obviously going to be there because of the things that Howard was just talking about. But I also try to point out that, you do want local control, and that's obviously one of the reasons why we have property taxes kind of driving this is that concept of the local school board doing that. So if you're going to have local control, the idea is that you raise as much as you can within a reasonable – as much as possible at the local level. But I say that, the state's job has been to try to – as best as possible equalize that and make it so that the inherent disparities that you have are ameliorated through what the state's able to do. And that's how the funding formula is designed to try to work. There's obviously going to be some challenges in how that's calculated because it's calculated on things like the property wealth district, the income of the folks that live in the school district and things like that. So it's an imperfect proxy, so to speak. But the thing I always say is that it's important that there's only so much state revenue to go around because of all the different things that we have in the state budget. And we have to be very wise in how we distribute those funds. So it makes sense that we're going to distribute a little bit more on the state side to those districts that have less capacity at the local level.
Philosophically, when you talk about equalizing, do you think in terms of equalizing up or equalizing down?
Well, I think that it's as much as possible, it's trying to equalize it up. I'd also, though, point out the one thing where we probably part a little company from some of the folks that brought the litigation and even a lot of members of the legislature and folks is we have the view that we really ought to conceptualize this in terms of funding students rather than funding systems. And so the funding formula is intended to look at the number of students. That's why there's some controversy that I know we'll get into about what right. The governor's current proposal is in the budget. But the goal is essentially to try to get more towards funding the students and having money to some extent being with the individual students and not necessarily saying, hey, it's going into the system, which the system by that, what I mean is it sounds ominous, but it's not. It's just that's you've got buildings, you've got capital expenditures, you've got transportation, you've got administrative costs. It's the whole network that makes up the school district. And we understand that that is what's there to serve the students. But I think a lot of times think about we got to take care of the system. And sometimes we shift our focus away from the student and kind of focus on how do we make sure that there's the same amount or more money always going into a district, notwithstanding what their actual numbers of enrollment are. And I think that's a critical distinction.
And Howard Fleeter, how do you feel about that?
I think there is a disagreement about, you hear a lot of rhetoric that we need to fund students, not adults, right? With the idea that somehow, what's the implication of that? That money somehow, when you're funding it to districts, it's really not going into the classroom or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think that, the reality is we have over 600 school districts. There's periodically talk of consolidation. Governor Kasich, raised that at the beginning of his first term. We haven't heard consolidation for a long time.
But I think, he did right, raise it recently
right.
again.
And I think that the reality is we still have 1.7 million kids in this state that need, they're educated in public schools, they're going to need to be educated. And, consolidation, a lot of the smaller districts are sparsely populated. They're in rural areas. You can't really, we've already got examples of districts that are, sharing treasurers. There's examples of districts that are actually sharing superintendents. You can do things within the structure of, no one today would probably create 600 school districts, but the cost of consolidating them I don't think is worth the savings that you'd get because you still have to educate those kids. You can't really save real money unless you're going to be closing buildings. And the sparsely populated districts, they're already, you really can't get much economies of scale. So I think, we have the number of districts that we have, and the way the system is designed, when I talked about those components of the formula, mm-hmm. I look at it and think they really are designed around the needs of students, right? That we look at, kids who are in poverty. Those kids have challenges that require additional services and resources. It's going to cost extra money. Kids with disabilities, it's the same thing. Career tech programs cost more money. Like I said, English language learners. I look at this system and I think that I look at it and think it is a kid-centered system. We funnel the money to 610, government entities, right? But I think it is kid-centered because the way the dollars are driven is based on the needs of kids. Where I think we need to improve is really getting back to making sure that the parameters in the formulas that reflect those costs are really based on the actual cost. And in the last 7 or 8 years, we've kind of lost that thread.
Right. Well, the state's willing at this point to pony up about $6,000 per student. That's the base funding, right? But no one's ever agreed that that's the proper amount of money to start at a base point, right, Greg Lawson?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you remember,
that's a premise that's, you know,
it is kind of it's not quite as bad as just throwing a dart at the thing and hope and seeing what the number lands on. It's not that bad, but there is a lot of debate about it. I mean, I think most people would intuitively say, wow, $2,000 or $3,000, way low. That doesn't make any sense. That'd be insane. And I think everybody would agree on that. But then you get to the point where the closest effort that I can think of, and since I've been following this, to try to get to what is the appropriate basket was Governor Strickland. Probably there was an effort to try to say, well, what are high-performing districts doing and what are high-performing districts spending and what is that accomplishing? Because that entails, you know, again, some of those ancillary services that are available. Sometimes it's the nature of the facilities, the equipment, the computers, connectivity to the internet, things that in some districts are difficult to do.
And sometimes it's the kids are getting them enough food at home. They have somebody working with them on reading at home, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the adequacy issue is, I think, there are a couple very concrete things that came out of the DeRolf decision. You know, one of them was literally a concrete thing. It was this $10 billion in school facilities, which has, you know, been unequivocally a positive thing for Ohio. We had buildings crumbling across the state. We really, before the DeRolf decision, there was essentially no state support. That was all done locally, and you saw the effects of that. That's been clearly a huge improvement. The other thing I think was, you know, that, you know, most people, when they think of, if you're aware of the DeRolf decision, you've probably heard the words over-reliance on the local property tax. And that was, I think, everybody who follows this decision wishes that the Supreme Court had been more specific, because there's several ways to interpret what that meant. Does it mean we can't use the property tax? Does it mean we use it too much? Does it mean we need a state property tax? It's open to interpretation. And, you know, that issue has changed a little bit in the 20 years since the decision, but maybe not as much as a lot of people think. But the third part of the decision, I think, that was really very important was the part that said, that referred to adequacy and said that the parameters in the formula have to be linked to the cost of educating students, you know, at some adequate level. And the, you know, the problem is that there's no universally regarded methodology for determining what that is. And in the 13 years immediately after the DeRolf decision, depending on how you count, we went through three or four different ways of doing this. And we started with an outcomes-based approach that identified school districts that were providing the outcomes that we thought were adequate. And then we looked at how much they spent. And then we kind of morphed that into something we called the building blocks approach, which is sort of a combination of switching over to inputs, of saying, rather than looking at, you know, what are the places that are providing a good education and looking at how much they spend, we said, what are the components of a good education and how much do they cost? And then, as Greg said, Governor Strickland's evidence-based model was probably like the, you know, we called that inputs approach the building blocks. And the evidence-based model, people called it the building blocks on steroids, right? I mean, it was a very, very detailed model that looked at classroom ratios. It looked at school counselors. It looked at support personnel. It looked at teachers. It used, you know, average salaries. It had an education challenge factor adjustment based on the difference in the needs of students. And it was so complicated, nobody understood it, really. It wasn't based on a per pupil amount. It was based on the characteristics of the district. And it only lasted 2 years because it was in place in the school years 2010 and 11, and Governor Strickland lost the election in 2011. And when Governor Kasich took over, they eliminated the evidence-based model.
Did they basically
model.
Revert back to all things being equal the way it had been before?
So what they did, because of the recession and the multi-billion-dollar budget hole, we spent 2 years literally without a school funding formula. It was called the bridge formula, and basically in 2011 and 12, or 2012 and 13, districts were basically getting a percentage of what they got in 2011. Then in 2014 and 15, we returned to a normal formula, and at that point, they set in 2014 the base per pupil amount. They set at $5,745 per pupil. And then in 2015, it went up to $5,800. In 2016, it went up to $5,900. In 2017, it went up to $6,000.
Ding, ding, ding.
Ding, ding, ding. So we're at nice round numbers. And you know, the last year that we had a per pupil amount that was based on a methodology was 2009, right before the evidence-based model. And in 2009, the number from the building blocks model was $5,732 per pupil. And so now, in 2017, we're at $6,000 per pupil. So that's $268 more if you just go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics CPI mm-hmm. calculator and punch in, 2008 and 2016, you'll get somewhere close to $6,400 if we had adjusted that for inflation. And so we're several hundred dollars below the inflation adjustment for the last time we did it. I think what we need to do, I think, is get back to thinking about the methodology. And even though, there's no perfect method, and I don't think we'll ever agree, is do you look at outcomes? Do you look at inputs? Do you do an evidence-based model? How do you do a statistical regression? There's several different ways of doing this. I think that having the discussion and thinking about what the needs are and how they change over time and how much money we need, I think that's a good discussion for the state to be engaging in periodically, and mm-hmm. I'd like us to get back to it. This budget, it's not going to happen. They kept the per pupil amount at $6,000 for 2 years. We know we have some revenue problems, and so we're not going to get caught up. But I think that linking the numbers in the formula to some sense of what the needs are, I think, is something that we really need to do. And when you update, whether you use an outcomes approach, an inputs approach, a statistical approach, I think thinking about what those are and then thinking about, how the money is spent, those are the things we really need to focus on.
We are going to continue this conversation. If you have a question or comment about school funding, this is your chance. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The governor has proposed a public education spending budget that would cut funding to well over half of all districts in Ohio. That's not going to go anywhere. We're talking about options today. Still with us is school data analyst for the Ohio Education Policy Institute, Howard Fleeter. Thanks again, Howard, for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And senior policy analyst at the Buckeye Institute, Greg Lawson. Thanks again, Greg.
Thank you.
Joining us by phone from Seattle is research professor and director of the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown University and the author of the book Educational Economics, Where Do School Funds Go? Marguerite Rosa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Marguerite Rosa, where do school funds go?
Well, I think the first question is how much are there? And I did hear a little bit of the previous conversation, and it's probably worth acknowledging that there is a base amount in the state formula, but then there's all the additional money that comes for different types of students if they have disabilities or have limited English proficiency. There's some additional federal money that comes in and a local share as well. In Ohio at the moment, the average expenditure is, and this is from a couple of years ago, so it may be higher now, about $11,500 per student. And so what we usually do is start with that big number, and then we look at how that money flows and whether or not it's equitable and driven out by students and student types and so on. And our research takes a look at what kinds of funding formulas yield different outcomes for students. And while I wish the answers were crystal clear, one of the things we've learned in the research is that two schools can spend the same amount of money on the same type of kids and even spend it in the same way and still get different outcomes. And that suggests that schools have a lot to do with what kind of outcomes that students get, and that funding formulas, instead of ignoring schools as important unit of change, ought to be enlisting schools in this effort of trying to leverage resources to get the greatest outcome possible.
How does a funding formula leverage local schools? How does that work?
That's the big question. One of the things we found is that the way not to do it is to tell schools how to do everything. So if your funding formula locks in, you know, class sizes and position counts and some of those kind of inputs-based or building block-based formulas that specify what the ingredients are for schools, then what we find is that schools shift over to being in compliance mode where, you know, they kind of throw up their hands and say it's not really our job to get the greatest outcomes possible for our dollars. The legislature has decided they are the ones in charge of that and told us exactly how to spend our money. And, in fact, when we survey principals, a colleague of mine did this recently, surveyed a lot of principals and asked them what stands in between you getting greater outcomes with the dollars that you have. They listed a dozen or more barriers in state and sometimes district policy that said that I would be able to do more for the students I have with the money that I have if my policy leaders would get out of the way.
What are some of the most familiar barriers that you're talking about there?
Well, I think there are sometimes you can imagine if you were a principal and you were handed a group of staff and you thought, gee, these aren't the positions I would choose if I had to serve these kids well. Or, you know, maybe you might say, what I really noticed that I need is something else, but our funding formula doesn't come with that. And right now, maybe my kids, like schools might be given a reading coach, but if they have a big attendance problem, then the reading coach could be there, but the kids are not. And they need to first work on attendance before they can then work on the secondary things. So schools know their communities. They know what works with their kids. They know what works with their staff. You know, their own staff may have strengths and weaknesses that they would accommodate in different kinds of ways than in sort of a standard factory model. And I think the one thing we've learned is that schools are anything but factories. And if you talk to people in schools, they're the first ones to tell you that all the human interactions inside schools matter a lot.
Well, that's the wild card. We're talking about humans.
Yes, we're talking about humans.
Wilder yet, young humans.
And including the kids and the parents and the neighbors mm-hmm. and, you know, whether or not there's been a crisis on campus in the last year or, you know, parents are losing their jobs or parents are getting new jobs or whatever it is. But we find that a flexible funding formula that funds students in a way that is equitable and weights students for their higher needs that they come with is the most likely to attract the kind of school effects that we want to take place on the school level. I think that those in schools aren't going to take on this challenge of trying to do the most with the resources they have unless they've been funded fairly. So if the funding formula must be fair, and unless the funding formula has acknowledged the difficult needs that come with some of their students. So if a school has many more low-income students or students that are have been out of school for a while or don't speak English or have a lot of disabilities, then, you know, there needs to be the additional funds that come with that mix of students.
There's that other piece of all of this, though, and that's that accountability issue. So we give you this money. You have to show us how you used it and prove that you used it in the best possible way, right?
And that's the last piece of this is kind of a transparent system. And I think Ohio is moving toward this direction where there will be emerging more and more data on how money is spent at the school level. But that if we want schools to kind of own this challenge, to have that ownership at the school level, then they also need tools to see how are other schools spending their money. Are there any good ideas in there that might play out to my school? But I worry that when people talk about accountability, sometimes they're saying what I want to do is micromanage how you're spending your money, and you know I get calls like this all the time as a research professor where a journalist might call and say I found a school they're spending their money on karate lessons, can you comment on that? And I would say, well, I think I can comment on it if I know how the school is doing. If they're performing well, seems like karate lessons are working well. If they're not performing well, then they might want to try doing something else. But we can't look at spending in isolation of outcomes. And I think what we should be looking at are the outcomes, not the spending patterns.
That's right. Can I, Marguerite,
yeah, Howard Fleeter,
this
yeah.
is Howard. Can I ask you a question? How do you view the role of the State Department of Education in this? Should they be doing things? Is their role to help districts figure out how to more productively spend their money? Is their role more hands off? It's just, you know, right now, you know, the money flows through them. They make the payments to the district. The reality at ODE downtown is, I think, that they're trying to keep their heads above water, just doing all the things that they're compelled with by law. Do you see other states where the State Department is providing more of a guidance role? Is that something that makes any difference?
Yeah, we do see a lot of state departments doing that, but I hesitate to say that that's the best way to go. I think the state education agency needs to provide the transparency so that that all the schools and districts know why they got the amount of money that they got, and then that transparency in how that spending translates to outcomes. So, you know, you spent this much money, and these are your outcomes. And it turns out that requirement is coming down through the new Every Student Succeeds Act, has a provision that requires financial transparency down to the school level. And then once there is that transparency, I think then individual schools and districts can use those transparent tools to look for the kinds of best practices that might work at their school without saying that this is what you should do. Because I think the minute the state agency says you should do this, they're taking away that control or that ownership that goes at the school level for them to interpret every sort of spending decision in their own context. And as an example, you know, everybody believes that more money in the classroom yields greater outcomes. It's relatively intuitive. We would all sort of feel good about that when school districts spent more money in their classroom. But a few years ago, one of the school districts in Ohio that had the greatest outcomes on a relative basis for the dollars it spent, I mean, it beat the outcomes for its students with the money it had spent less of that money proportionately in the classroom. So should we tell them to stop doing that when it seems to be working? And I don't know if they put money into sort of wraparound kinds of programs around schools, or they had things that motivated students more, or if they just had top-notch leaders that somehow motivated the staff. I can't really explain what it is. But we just need to stop short of saying that all the answers come from outside the school.
Greg Lawson, that local control, is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think that's definitely part of it, and I agree with a lot of what she's been saying. And interestingly enough, there's a lot of stuff that's intangible and is intuitive only at the level where the leaders actually are. You know, in my private capacity, I actually served on a charter school board for a few years. I don't anymore, but it was actually a very high-performing charter school. It's one of in terms of buildings, it's actually higher than a lot of school districts here in Columbus. And what was interesting was the leadership, really got students motivated. And what I liked about it was there was almost like competitions between classrooms as they were preparing for tests and stuff like that. So they were learning things. And then it was like, well, we're going to compete against this classroom and that classroom.
And that worked in that school.
And it worked very well. And they achieved extremely well. And even the different gaps between some of the subpopulations were not quite as high. And I think that the interesting thing was, I'm not sure that would work for every student population. I mean, the charter schools obviously have mobility issues in terms of who gets in there and stuff. But I think what I saw there was, wow, kids were learning, and in that case, they were probably learning less because they wanted to learn and more because they were saying things like, we want to beat Dublin or something like that. We want to win. We want to perform better. And it was a competitive ethos that was there. That worked there. And I guess those are some of the intangible things, and is one of the reasons why the Buckeye Institute has a little more, I guess, skepticism about sometimes when we get stuck in the conversation about all the dollars. I think that we want to see where the dollars flow and we want to see outcomes, but that's kind of why I mentioned earlier on about the issue with students and making sure that also there's a certain level of parental responsibility. I mean, it's no secret we support school choice and things like that, and there's obviously going to be problems. I mean, there's areas where parents aren't as engaged in some communities. Well, challenges that they're—I mean, just things that are inherent on a case-by-case basis, and you don't know what that's going to be, and you can't count on that all the time. But there's those intangible things that have such an impact that the dollars don't always equate to it. I mean, if you look at longitudinal studies for like long-term outcomes, if you look at NAEP scores or you look at SAT scores and things like that, you'll see that spending nationally has continued to increase when you factor in both state, local, and actually federal dollars too. And you don't always see the kind of increases in the outcomes academically based on just the amount of money that's being spent. So there's obviously a lot of other issues that are at play. And so we want to be careful that we understand that there is a base amount. Everybody knows that you can't do like, oh, we're only going to spend $500 per student or some kind of, again, insane number. But we also have to ask, is 6,000 right? Should it be 7,000? What is, and again, the student, and there's going to be the differentiation amongst students that we've been talking a lot about. For some students, $3,000 might be completely adequate. And for some, you may need the $11,000, $12,000 because they have all these other issues. They may have home issues that are there. They may have the language, not English language mm-hmm. issues. And there's a whole host of things. So, you know, I agree with flexibility. And I think that that's one of the things that we always like is flexibility so that there are people who can be creative. I mean, that's sort of the whole free market notion that obviously we're a free market organization. We believe in that. So we want that.
Is there a but coming up here?
No, actually. Right. Okay. No, actually, in this case, believe it or not, no, there's not one. Okay. Because flexibility is going to be the king. And in some ways, that might be even more important than just focusing as much on the dollars.
Yeah. And Howard Fleeter?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, this is an area that I think Greg and I are largely in agreement on, particularly when we talk about the needs of low-income students. And, you know, I spend, you know, a lot of my time working on the nuts and bolts of the formula, and I think over the last 20 years the formula is better than it was before our court decision. I think it still has some areas that it can improve. I mean, but what really keeps me up at night, and I'm not exaggerating, is that, you know, when you look at, you know, I also spend time looking at the performance of districts and looking at the, you know, the course offerings and things like that. And we see a lot of disparities. Rural areas don't offer the same type of curriculum as suburban areas. Their kids don't have the same opportunities. They don't have, you know, they might have one foreign language. They don't have advanced classes. They're not as prepared for college. Mm-hmm. When you look at some of the basic metrics on test scores, they may be proficient, but they're not doing much beyond proficiency. But the thing that there's a performance gap related to kids in poverty that is persistent and disturbing. And every year when the report card data comes out, I make the same very simple analysis and I look at the districts that score high on our test and districts that score low. And, you know, it's consistent that the lowest performing districts averaged about 80% economically disadvantaged students. The highest performing districts averaged less than 10% economically disadvantaged students. And it's a straight line in between. And it's been like this for years.
Right.
And it's not news. The Coleman Report studied this in 1966, which was 50 years ago, and showed the importance of socioeconomics and achievement. But it's persistent. And when you look at more advanced metrics of high school graduation, career tech preparedness, college matriculation, we see the same gaps. And that's the issue that we really need to figure out how to get kids that are coming from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. And just because you're poor doesn't mean you can't learn, but there's a breakdown in our system that these kids are not making the same progress. And from a societal perspective, I can't think of a more important issue for this state to face. And, you know, when you look at the funding, you know, it's whether it's 6,000 per pupil or whether that should be 6,400. What I look at when we look at the economic disadvantaged money, since, you know, we're spending 13% more on funding for kids in poverty in 2016 than we were in 2001. But the percentage of kids in poverty has gone up by more than 50% over that time. So we're not making the commensurate effort to do that. And I think we need to put more money in. And I think we need to think about how to productively spend it. If we spend it the same way we have, we may not get the results. But can we start earlier? If we wait till kids are 5 years old and they're coming to kindergarten and they don't know their letters and numbers and aren't used to a classroom environment, we're behind already. Can you do the math?
Well, that's that second part around the productivity that I think relates to the funding formula. And one of the things we've been doing is drilling down in states on like schools. So instead of saying, how are the poor schools doing compared to the more affluent schools, we start by, let's just take a look at the low-income schools or student schools with high numbers of kids who are in poverty and compare them to each other. And we find, interestingly, that some are doing quite a bit better than others. So some have been more successful, maybe not as successful as we want them to be, but some have been more successful than their peers, which means that even within those subsets, there's a lot that the schools could learn from each other, and there's still a lot of school effects they could harness as part of this effort to try to translate dollars into greater outcomes. If we're, as a state, unhappy with our outcomes all across the board for a particular student type, that's a great reason to increase the weight for that student type. So if our low-income students on average are still doing really quite poorly, we might want to increase that weight for that student group while also still watching within that batch of students where there are more successes relative to others. And that's when we can start putting
them. I agree with you completely.
We are going to take a quick break, then we're going to get back to it. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's a new session of the Ohio General Assembly. That means a new state budget and a new conversation about state funding of public education. Still with us by phone from Seattle is research professor and director of the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown University, Marguerite Rosa. Also with us, school data analyst for the Ohio Education Policy Institute, Howard Fleeter, and senior policy analyst at the Buckeye Institute, Greg Lawson. Questions or comments, don't wait till the end, 614-292-8513. Marguerite Rosa, we were talking about this off air. I wanted to bring it up with you. How much, I mean, Ohio is one of maybe 6 to 10 states that has this, what I think of as this particular issue, and that is diversity, not just in student population, of course, but just in circumstances of districts. We have urban districts, but all the urban districts are different from each other. We have rural districts. Those all are different from each other. I mean, how do you compare apples to apples in a state like Ohio?
That's a great question. The one thing that we talk about for funding formulas is that they tend to be around for 2 or 3 decades, and it's very hard for states to change their funding formulas. And not only could the composition of districts change during that time, but the landscape of student populations could change during that time, but even the ways that we serve students can change. There's innovations coming out right and left that affect how schooling is done with different groups of students. But the one thing that seems to stay the same is that we still have students. So the best way to structure a funding formula so that it can be dynamic and work across many different types of districts is to fund the students. And that means you have a dollar amount that goes out per student, and then additional dollar amounts that go out per student type. And then it's up to each individual district to take into account its context and its unique circumstances and translate those dollars into outcomes. And I think it was Greg or maybe Howard who mentioned that, sometimes rural districts, they don't have the resources to offer as many different types of students.
Yeah, Howard, yeah.
Or classes. And, you know, my own students went, my own children went to a rural school for a while, was one school in the district, K through 12, with only about 40 kids per grade. And yet they were able to offer a full complement of AP courses in the high school because they had tapped into online coursework and figured out how to weave that into their regular programming. So there are, I mean, different districts handle these things in different ways, but the key here is to make sure that the school districts and the schools don't have the shackles of state policy that limit their thinking about what's possible. And then they can tap into that data and see that maybe there are other rural districts that are getting more kids to take and pass AP tests. And if we want that for our community, we might need to try some of these other strategies. And that means using our money differently.
The governor wants to limit, change the funding for schools that have a 5% or more decrease in student population. Can you talk, and I want all of you to talk about this whole economies of scale issue that schools grapple with. They still have to turn the lights on. They still have to heat the room, whether there's 20 kids in the room or 30 kids in the room.
That's true. But so I think we often think that, you know, if a school district loses a student, their expenditures don't reduce proportionately. But at the same time, across the country, there are, you know, 14,000 school districts of all different sizes. And as they grow, you know, they incrementally add expenditures. And yet they find it harder as they shrink to incrementally reduce expenditures. And that's true. It's hard. It's not easy for them. But at the same time, you know, there's a limited pool of funds in the state. And if a state chooses to add more resources to school districts that have a declining enrollment, and I mean more resources on a per pupil basis, mm-hmm. that means there are fewer dollars than for other districts that might be the exact same size, but they're not in student enrollment decline. And so when we look at school districts, we notice that while reducing expenditures is tough, if school districts design their own budgets around student counts, so they fund their schools based on student counts and they fund their central office based on student counts, then they're going to be more nimble and be able to both grow and contract when student enrollments change. Hmm. And they do change. All across the country, enrollments change. And so we can hold districts harmless, which has this effect of giving them sort of extra money because they used to be larger, but that means there'll be fewer dollars for their other.
Howard Fleeter.
Yeah. And Marguerite, I mean, I you know agree with you on that point, right? That, you know, as districts, you know, lose enrollment, even though, you know, sometimes you need to lose enough kids in one grade so that you can make significant adjustments, but still, if over time you're losing enrollment, you know, you in theory shouldn't lose. You know, need the same amount of money. The argument we've been having with the governor's office over the past couple of years has been that in Ohio, there's, you know, we have put districts on a guarantee, and we've been doing so for, you know, the last 25, 30 years of one type or another. Your funding, if it goes down, is linked to some prior year at not always 100%, sometimes less than that. And the point that we've been trying to make is that, you know, there's three reasons why a district might get less money in one year than they got in the previous year. One is that you'll have fewer kids. One is that your property value changes, and the property value is the basis of the state and local share calculation. And when they redid our formula, when they updated our state share index in the governor's proposal, 373 out of the 610 school districts had their state share go down because of how property values have changed. And so, you know, last year we had, you know, about 120 districts on the guarantee. And under the governor's proposal this year, we've got over 300 districts on the guarantee. And that's largely being driven by valuation change, not by enrollment loss from one year to the next. And then the third reason is just the formula itself. And so as we make changes to our formula, as you add a component or you direct funding from one to another and you put more money in maybe to special ed than you did into the base cost or whatnot, the formula itself causes districts to get more or less money as that sort of morphs over time. And so you know, like they said, the point we've tried to make to the administration is they're zeroing in on the enrollment loss when there's actually a couple other factors in the formula that also affect whether a district gets less. And so I think it's, you know, it's balancing those different factors. And so, you know, clearly, I think what's going on in the budget that the governor has just introduced is because of the revenue problems that we're seeing, that our tax revenues are not coming in as estimated for this year, and they're lowering the estimates for the next couple of years. They've decided to freeze all the parameters in the formula. So when your state share goes down, you don't have any sort of wiggle room that your per pupil amount went up and it would mask that. So all these districts get thrown on the guarantee. Then they have to figure out some way to reduce the cost, and it becomes a quagmire.
That goes to my next question. Yeah. And Greg Glossy, maybe you can pick this up. What other entity that operates with budgets the likes of, say, even a nice big suburban or, you know, urban or any school district what other entity every 2 years gets jerked around the way school districts do?
Well,
how in the world do they plan? Not to mention the fact that we're not talking about chalkboards and erasers anymore. We're talking about high technology, you know, really complicated stuff that they need to fund.
Well, I think the biggest problem is that we've actually, since Kasich's been in office and really going back to before that, some states have school funding formulas that are in existence for years. Ohio has had school funding systems ever since the Roth
changed all the time. That's what I've grown up with as a journalist.
The problem is we're kind of an anomaly because we keep changing it. And then of course, even as Howard mentioned, we didn't even have really a formula when Kasich first came into office.
Right.
Then we sort of go back to a formula, but then we have caps and guarantees. Which is what we've been talking about. How are schools supposed to plan? Well, I think the problem is that we've been changing it so much. The one thing that I think the governor's been trying to do, and I think he deserves some credit, is he's trying to say in this budget, look, we have a funding formula, and it's the caps and guarantees that we've been talking about just now that actually distorts that formula. If you didn't have those distortions, you would actually be able to at least
because you would know. All things being equal, how many students.
Even if you disagreed with the outcome of it, at least you'd know. But now what happens is this is the funding formula, but you have no idea what the General Assembly is going to do because they're going to ostensibly, and I think everybody expects, they're not going to actually do the funding formula. They're going to find some way to avoid that happening. And so then, you know, everybody's like, well, we don't really know. And it could be completely different the next GA versus what it was this GA. I think that's actually our problem is we don't have any stability on the formula. There's a recognition in the General Assembly, and certainly I think Governor Kasich recognizes and the administration recognizes it. But then you get to the point of, do we need to change the formula again?
Who's going to be the first one to say, stop the madness?
Right.
Marguerite Rosa, how does Ohio stack up? I mean, the rest of the country. Is it really that much of an anomaly?
In terms of the mix of districts?
The stability of the formula.
Well, no. I mean, it's not. I mean, this is kind of thing goes on actually in a lot of public sectors. And, you know, education is actually 80% labor. So it sounds like it's like a lot of high-tech costs, but it's really predominantly labor. That doesn't make it any easier to manage the budget from year to year, of course. But the legislatures do this, you know, they all the time, where their revenues aren't what they predicted, or they have other competing priorities, and that might be higher education or corrections or social services or other kinds of things that are competing with education in state budgets. And, you know, we have elections, and so legislatures can go one direction and then the next. And one year, you know, they can states can experience a cut, and the next year they can experience growth. And I think that's part of it is a challenge for school districts for a lot, but it's a challenge for many industries. And so keeping a budget that is a little bit more nimble and flexible that pushes down some of that flexibility down to the school so that schools can take the incremental dollars they have in any given year and apply them in ways that meet whatever needs that their students have with the dollars that they have that particular year is really the goal here. But it's not unusual. I think Ohio is similar to a lot of states.
What the Obama administration's school improvement grants program, when we start to remove funding to that level, to the federal level, where it's coming down from the federal level, they're having to be accountable to the state, they have to be accountable to the taxpayers, the state, legislature, and now federal government, although that's probably going to get
changed.
Swept away in the maelstrom. But Greg Lawson?
Well, I agree with a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of the flexibility and letting us, whatever the pools of money are. I mean, we want accountability. Obviously, I mean, look, we're for transparency and accountability on tax dollars and everything else, but we have to be very careful that we don't waste so much time and we actually do create some of these straitjackets and mandates that create an inability to be adaptable. And so I guess one of the things we'd love to see eventually, and I guess when I say funding the students, you know, letting the money go with a student, following the students and whatever mechanism that is, and then saying, okay, these are, you know, certain standards that we have, and not to get into all the debate about what are the standards, because that's a whole other set of issues, but these are the standards that we agree on. Do they meet them or not? And what the heck do I care about how it is achieved? and then allowing the local boards and local superintendents and building people like the guy I was talking about at the charter school, doing those kind of things. That is flexibility in the free market and doing it so we stop having to worry about that. So even as all this money funnels in from different sources, let's say, look, what we care about is, are we getting kids who are learning? Are we getting kids who can get a job and be happy mm-hmm. in the future? And if they're meeting a certain objectives, I don't really care. It's local folks making those decisions within and all. That I think, is the key.
How
is
yeah.
And the federal law returned a lot of that control yeah. to states and local communities
right.
in this last round.
Yeah.
Howard Fleeter?
And I think, you know, when I spend a lot of time talking to treasurers and superintendents and school board members about this. And I actually hear, I mean, I hear a lot of frustration about the instability of the school funding formula from year to year. I hear even more complaints about the instability of our testing standards and those things.
That's,
I mean,
that's
on the
that changes every year too.
On the ground, that is caught our report card measures, how we evaluate schools, what our students are expected to learn, how districts are expected to align their curriculum from one year to the next. I think if we were to provide stability to school districts on one thing, start with that, and
okay.
then the, you know, the funding system is large
follows.
Enough. It's kind of like turning the Titanic, that, you know, these cuts are real to people, but I think the frustration in terms of what they're supposed to be doing in the classroom, how it's evaluated, you know, what kids are supposed to be learning, that's causing a lot of angst in this state for school people and parents and students.
Howard Fleeter from the Ohio Education Policy Institute, also Greg Lawson from the Buckeye Institute, and Marguerite Rosa, director of the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown University. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.